have a confession to make that's not really news to anyone, or a confession. I too grumble and murmur. I complain. I grow impatient. One of my many flaws, indeed. One such occasion was last Sunday afternoon. You know, one of the pet peeves I have is when we are driving in traffic and people are slow to respond to the right of way, or when the light changes, or after having spent sufficient time vacationing at a stop sign. Get on with it, you know, get on with it. We need to move, places to go, things to do. Some of it is a fault of a too tight a schedule and not leaving myself enough time to get from one place to another, and that's a problem. But some of it really has to do with an impatience inside at times. This particular day last week, Wendy and I were making our way home from an event and pulled up behind a car, and it stopped at a stop sign, and there were pedestrians going by. And they went. They were gone. No others in sight. A jogger had clearly indicated that she was going to stop and wait and jog on site while the car went, and signal to the car. It stayed, did not move. For some reason, I didn't on this occasion give a little toot on my horn. I did not. But I waited and I said, what's taking this person so long? Only to observe very shortly after, the car moving slowly straight ahead. It was a T-junction. Slowly straight ahead, up the sidewalk and into the fence. I pulled my car out because something was not right. Pulled my car around, jumped out of the car, and there in the car was a woman slumped over. She had passed out. And we called 911, and by that time she had revived, and they were going to check her, and I hope and pray everything was okay. But I was brought up short because I was reminded at that moment, we never know the whole story. We grumble and we complain from a particular vantage point, perhaps of entitlement, perhaps of impatience or whatever, but we never know the whole story. We never have the whole picture, do we? And I think it's like that when we look at our text today, the principal one from Exodus and from Matthew, because in both of them we see grumbling. A grumbling that invites us to situate ourselves and to say, what is it that we might learn not only about them or not only about ourselves, but about God? What do these texts disclose about the nature of God coming and being proximate to us in whatever state we find ourselves, especially those of dire need? In the Hebrew Scriptures, in the Exodus lesson, it's a very interesting development in the drama. They have come out of perilous, tortuous years, decades of suffering, hundreds of years of suffering, a legacy, and they have been liberated into the wilderness. They are in transition between slavery in Egypt and the Promised Land, wandering through the wilderness. In the wilderness, because wilderness stuff is hard. Wilderness is not only a physical place necessarily as where the story takes place, but it is a metaphor for all that you and I go through, and we even as nations go through. Sometimes a period of lostness where we have to clarify what is important. We are in between, in transition. They are being tested in that moment between leaving and believing. Trusting God for the future that is promised and leaving something that was familiar, although arduous and tortuous, yet familiar. And that is what they begin to grumble about. Food is scarce. Anxiety is high. And they complain. But they're not the only ones. In 1770, Edmund Burke published a little treatise called Thoughts on the Cause of the Present Discontents. See if we don't see ourselves in this at every generation. His perception sounds like the contemporary reality in Israel and in ourselves in terms of the story. He wrote, "To complain of the age we live in, to murmur at the present possessors of power, to lament the past, to conceive extravagant hopes for the future are the common dispositions of the greatest part of humankind." It's what we do. It's not only the Israelites, it's not only the laborers in the vineyard. You and I do this. And so as we read this story, see if we cannot situate ourselves in the same outpouring, as it were, of human need and cry and desolation. They are hungry and they complain to Moses, and Moses reminds them, "You're not only complaining to me, you're complaining to God." But we have learned something about the God already as disclosed through Genesis and this far in Exodus. We've learned that this God has been received and apprehended by the people as El Shaddai, the provider. So they demonstrate a growing awareness and knowledge of, as God discloses God's self in new ways to the people as they're ready to receive it. El Shaddai is understood as a God, a kind of a fertility deity, as it were. For this God, El Shaddai, provides for the nation to multiply, provides for work, provides the land, provides for health and generativity. And they've known that. But their experience is different. The suffering that they have endured, the slavery that they have been a part of in Egypt, the death and the violence, and now the rescue, occasions for them a new need. So when God speaks to Moses, as we read a number of weeks ago, and discloses God's name, when Moses says, "Whom should I say has sent me to liberate these people?" And God responds, "Eye asher eye. I am who I am. I will be who I will be. I will be what I will be." It is very indeterminate. It is a kind of name that is both disclosive and revealing, but also mysterious. And they now begin to encounter this God, this Yahweh, as it were, as a God who hears them. Not only a God who provides generativity, but this now we see a different dimension of God. For we're told, I have heard the cries of the people, and I have responded. I have come down to rescue them. This is a God now we understand who responds to sorrow and despair, who will even entertain grumbling. For in response to the grumbling in the wilderness, they are told that they will be provided for. They will be given meat in the evening, the quails, and they will be given bread in the day, in the morning. We are not to think and assume that grumbling and complaining is the way generally to engage God. It is not the grumbling and the complaining that is most prominent here. It is, I believe, the recognition that we are in need, that we are desolate. It is the cry of the soul. I would prefer a murmurer and a grumbler to those who believe themselves self-sufficient and in no need of any help. Once we recognize that our need is great and it is beyond our self-sufficiency, we cry out to God. It may not be the best way, but we cry out to God, and God pays attention to those who have identified the source of their despair and the source of their pain and cries out for help. I believe that this is part of the way that God is involved in shaping the people of Israel, in preparing them for the promised land, even as God is shaping us here at Parkdale. Is challenging us to look at our life together and to ask, not only personally, but corporately, what is it? What is it that we have put aside, that we have eschewed as that which provides for our own needs? What is it that we have forgotten to do? How have we forgotten to love? As the choir sang, are there ways in which we have not surmounted the walls of separation? And the kind of community that will indeed be a testament to God's capacity to bring disparate people with different dreams, different aspirations, but a common need and a common awareness of God and of the quest for spiritual fulfillment and the need to engage the world. How is this done? The people are provided for. Not because they grumbled, but because of this God who discloses a new way of being and being identified to them. You know that sometimes people get trapped between realities. You remember Aldous Huxley's Brave New World? In that book, he describes a certain utopia of a world without suffering, a world with no pain. And as the people are described in this particular world, we realize that there is a deep problem. Yes, they go along and everything seems fine and placid and docile. But do you notice when you read that book, what do the people have to have every month? An injection of adrenaline. Their lives are adrenaline free, and so they need injections of adrenaline. What we know biologically and physically is that we need adrenaline to live. The adrenaline that is stirred by the experiences of a broad range of emotions, including how we respond to suffering and pain. Somehow in that world, it is unreal, and in our imaginations, when we think, oh, the world would be so great if there was absolutely no pain or no suffering, somehow this reality doesn't seem to fit our human need. It is in pathos, it is in pain that we respond with courage and love and generosity and sacrifice. Those aspects and vistas of human response and life would never be experienced if there was no suffering, no pain. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not here offering some kind of paean and celebration for suffering, no matter what. We are to respond to it, but it is a reality in life, and we should not be trying to escape it, rather to engage and to see what are the lessons and what are the resources that can be marshaled, both in ourselves and in the community, in the world, so that we may respond. I can't help when I read this week as I prepared for today, and some of you, it may be even in your minds. How can this provision of God be made for the people in the wilderness? What about the people in the Horn of Africa and other places in the world? Why isn't God providing quail and manna for them? One of the interesting things about the story is the cooperation of creation in the acts of God's generosity. The quails come, and there is actually a process in what was laid, what looked like frost as it were, through insects and of the tamarisk tree that is deposited. And the people reflected and saw the provision of God. Could it be that the cooperation with creation is also at work today? God calling on you and on me and on the many Canadians and others around the world who have generously responded on diplomatic maneuvering and commitments to challenge those warlords who would prevent the aid from getting in. That is the miracle of cooperation with God's provision. You and I are not to be engaged in dreaming about this life being without suffering and hardship. For we have discovered that it is in the midst of that we are shaped. Some of us would want to live between two realities. Charles Dickens' Great Expectations. Do you remember Mrs. Havisham? Mrs. Havisham was jilted on the day of her wedding. By the time she's introduced to us in the book, Dickens describes an elderly woman still in her wedding dress, smelly and tattered and decrepit, in the room where the reception was to have taken place before she was abandoned, before she got married. The wedding cake on the buffet table, now after all of these decades, desiccated and worm-infested. Sometimes the liberation from God and from the community that will respond to God's prompting comes to rescue people who are frozen in their suffering, who are stuck there, see no way, no life, no hope. Part of the way God shapes us is to be attentive to each other and the world. Where on one hand people want to escape the reality of this life, on another hand they have been so affected, so abused, so impacted that they are stuck there. Ours is a response of grace and generosity in the way of Christ, through the mercy of God, to bring that liberation, to bring that shaping of a community and of a person. The murmuring in the parable has to do with what you and I have, a pride and a sense of privilege. Do you notice that why they are murmuring? Do you notice what is the statement that they make? They are complaining against the landowner who has given the equal amount of money to those who worked for 1 hour as those who worked the whole day. They are complaining because, in their words, you, meaning the landowner, dare to make them equal to us. What is it about our sense of self and our sense of importance that makes us feel that we de facto, automatically, are better than anyone else? Why is it that in our living, somehow we feel that what we are entitled to, other people are not, that we are scandalized by the indiscriminate grace of God? The parable invites us to look deep within our murmuring and our grumbling about what other people are getting. It's okay if we get it. I don't hear people complaining, oh, look at the wonderful blessing. I better murmur and grumble about that. Why do we murmur and grumble about those whom we believe don't deserve it? Somehow, God thinks that they need it. And who are we to judge the scandalous mercy and generosity of God? Sure, it doesn't feel right. And it is because we live according to another system, a system of merit. A system of you work hard, you do your time, you be respectful, you be a good citizen, and it should pay off. That's the ethos and the ethic by which we live. But we know for a fact that that is so flawed. Look at the people who have given their lives in dutiful work, loyal workers for a company or an agency, only to be told, we don't need you anymore. Those who follow the instruction to study hard and stay in school and work your tail off because you'll be rewarded with a good job. Those who followed all those meritorious maneuvers and yet they find themselves in ill straits and difficulty. Our system that we think is so sacrosanct doesn't work. 2008 and 2009, the crisis of housing and banks that multiplied all over the world, caused by the greed and the hubris and the evil of some who schemed, caused tremendous pain for so very many people, demonstrates that our meritocracy and our ways of orderly discharging the way things ought to be doesn't work either. Does it mean we shouldn't work hard? We shouldn't do our duty? No. But what it means is that in this complex life in which we live, in the various vectors and forces that are at work, we must realize that God must be intervening to correct our foolishness, our lack of wisdom, our pride, our evil, our constructions of systems of injustice. And sometimes as that is shaken out by the gifts of grace, it doesn't look right, doesn't feel right. Well, you know what? That's our problem. It's not God's problem. God is seeking to shape us. To shape us into a people who recognize the need to rely on God and to live according to those blessings, to steward them in ways that continue to build up the kingdom. Charlie Brown comes in one of the Peanuts cartoon strips leading up to Christmas, and Sally's sister's writing out a long, long list about all that she wants. All she wants for Christmas, going up to Santa Claus, the North Pole, a long list. And then at the end puts, well, if you can't give me all of these, at least give me most. And Charlie says, well, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? He's quite dismayed about this egregious sense of self-focus. And Sally responds, I'm only asking for what I deserve, for what's rightfully mine. God has established that what we, you and I, and the world deserves is God's grace, is God's mercy, is God's disclosure from God's own heart that is broken by our suffering, broken by our evil and our pain, and will not abandon this creation, that will shape us, and that shaping is going to hurt, that shaping is going to be uncomfortable, but that shaping is necessary for us to catch a glimpse, to embrace, and to live according to the values and the ethos of God's kingdom, the gospel that Jesus came to live and share. How about it? How about we help each other get shaped? I'm not talking about signing up for Good Life. That's a good thing to do, or some other place of being in shape and fitness. But how about if you and I covenant and help each other as we begin our new season of life and ministry here at Parkdale? How about if we help each other get shaped by God, opening to God's Spirit, challenging our assumptions, probing our murmuring and our complaining for disclosures of what may be at odds with God's purposes? How about it? Will you join me? Will you help me to allow ourselves to be shaped by God? Amen.